afternoon. Welcome to the Peter Mac Show. I'm your host, Peter McCandless. Today is January 30th, 2004. A nice wintry day here in Kansas City. Actually, the skies are fairly clear, but the temperature is hovering, Matt told me, around 14 with a wind chill, putting us near zero right now. So it's par for the course here in this part of the country, but hopefully in a week or so or less, it'll be a little warmer. This show, of course, is dedicated to the promotion of individual rights as exemplified in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. And the show topic today is going to be related to the income tax, which I've done more times than any other topic, and I'll be introducing my guest in just a minute. I want to remind my listeners that the video that Larkin Rose produced, Theft by Deception, is available at the KCXL bookstore in Independence, Missouri. You can call the bookstore at 836-7474. And, of course, his video, Theft by Deception, is also available through his website by that name, theftbydeception.com. So if you want to get a hold of that video, that would be the thing to do. A new device, which Dave and I will discuss, I'm sure, a bit, is coming out hopefully within a month. But anyway, as I alluded to, my guest today is Mr. Dave Champion. He was on with me last summer. Dave Champion is the executive director of Original Intent. The website for that is originalintent.org. He is also the founder of nontaxpayer.org, and he is a radio talk show host just like me. He has the American Radio Show with the website of americanradioshow.us, and he was gracious enough to have me on as his guest last Saturday night, and I believe that's still archived at his website, americanradioshow.us. So, Dave, thanks again for coming back on the Peter Mac Show, and we're going to talk today about what employers are required to withhold, right?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Peter. We did have a great time Saturday, by the way.
It was fun.
We'll probably tell your listeners the reason I had Peter on was because his experience is trying to get paid attorneys to answer questions about tax law was so amusing. I wanted Peter to share that with my audience, and we had a lot of fun Saturday.
Absolutely.
The purpose of today's show is to talk. We want to direct our conversation towards employers. Now, the conversation is going to be interesting for employees as well, but we really want to talk to employers because in this area, in employment taxes, employers can be both the solution or they can be the problem.
Okay.
Peter, I know in a lot of cases you do shows on the income tax.
Right.
And employment taxes, of course, are one of the things that make it the most difficult for American citizens who read the law, who get educated, and who determine for themselves that they are non-taxpayers. Definition of non-taxpayer being that they don't have any Subtitle A or Subtitle C tax liability.
Okay.
We're not going to talk about the other subtitles that deal with taxes on fuel and taxes on tires, because that's irrelevant to the vast majority of Americans.
Right.
So when we talk about employment taxes, we're really talking about the guy who goes out, he finds himself a good job, and he works for a few days, and all of a sudden somebody comes along from HR, and they drop a packet of papers on his desk, and they say, all right, Bob, you got to fill these papers out and get it back to me within 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Well, oftentimes, one of the documents that is in there, almost always, is a Treasury Department Form W-4.
Okay.
And a lot of employers erroneously take the position that nobody can work for them unless they get one of those forms.
Okay.
Now, let me explain why this is erroneous.
Okay.
There's a whole lot of reasons. There's both fundamental law reasons and there's statutory law reasons, and I want to go into both of those with your audience.
Okay.
And by the way, if you do take callers on your show, Peter, I forget.
Yes, yeah, and we certainly do, and we can do that at any point that you're ready to. But maybe
certainly. I just wanted the callers to know that if they want to call in about this, we can certainly bat this around.
Sure, and I'll give that number in just a few minutes.
Okay, great. Now, the first question, whenever we talk about a tax, is does the government have the right to impose that type of tax?
Right.
Now, of course, if you ask the government, they'll tell you they have the right to impose any tax anywhere, anytime, on anyone or anything. Fortunately for us, that is completely false. They do not have that right. One of the earliest cases that the Supreme Court heard that looked at taxation, part of the holding in that case, part of the dicta in the case, was that the power to tax is the power to destroy.
Exactly.
Therefore, no tax can ever be laid upon something which is a fundamental right, which is oftentimes also referred to as inalienable right. And we get that terminology from the Declaration of Independence.
Right.
So if something is an inalienable right, that means, according to the Declaration of Independence, which, according to the United States government, is the organic law of the United States,
mm-hmm.
we have certain inalienable rights granted by the Creator.
Right.
Now, if you read through the writings of the Founding Fathers, what they meant by that was that there are certain rights which every human being has, and the government may not alter, modify, or abolish those rights at all, ever.
Right.
Okay. So let's take a look and see what the Supreme Court has said some of those rights are, and then we'll determine if the government can use this taxing power, which is the power to tax as the power to destroy,
right.
to destroy those rights, and then we're going to look and see what the government has in fact done and what they have not done.
Okay.
Okay. Supreme Court has said, this is from a case called Coppedge v. Kansas.
Okay.
Included in the right of personal liberty is the right to make contracts for the acquisition of property. Chief among such contracts is that of personal employment, by which labor and other services are exchanged for money and other forms of property. Now, that's pretty clear, and it says such contracts such as personal employment.
Right.
So when you go in to get a job someplace, you are contracting. Now, the Internal Revenue Code may say, you know, independent contractor or you know, whether you're a employee, but in point of fact, you are always contracting for your labor.
Sure.
The Supreme Court has said that is a fundamental right that all Americans have.
Right. Dave, could you just repeat that case for us again, please?
Sure. It's Coppedge v. Kansas. It's spelled C-O-P-P-A-G-E v. Kansas.
Okay.
And the site is 236 U.S. 1.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. The next quote is from Butchers Union Company versus Crescent City Company. And it says, the property that every man has is his personal labor, as it is the original foundation of all other property. So it is the most sacred and inviolable to hinder his employment in whatever manner he thinks proper without injury to his neighbors is a plain violation of that most sacred right.
Wow, that's powerful, isn't it?
It is indeed. And we've got a few more here, and then we'll move on to what all this
sure,
means.
Sure, go ahead.
This is from Adair v. U.S., and it says, in our opinion, that section, in the particular mentioned, is an invasion of the personal liberty as well as the right of property guaranteed by the Fifth Amendment. Such liberty and right embrace the right to make contracts for the purchase of labor or of others, and equally to the right to make contracts for the sale of one's own labor. Okay?
Okay.
Now, we might say, is the court watchful for the fact that the Congress and the executive branch might try to encroach on our rights through the power of taxation? And in Loan Association v. Topeka, the court said, it must be conceded that there are such rights in every free government beyond the control of the state. Of all the powers conferred upon the government, that of taxation is most liable to abuse.
Wow. I've never heard that before, Dave. That's fantastic.
So what the court is saying is that we have a right to contract our labor out, a fundamental right, not some sort of right that the government created as a privilege and they refer to it as a right, which is quite common these days.
Correct.
But we have a fundamental constitutional right to contract out our own labor and to contract with others for their labor.
Sure.
Now, we know that the power to tax is the power to destroy. So if there is a tax upon that right, then the government has the right, they has the ability, excuse me, the power to destroy that right.
Correct.
And the Supreme Court has even said if there's an area that is most likely for the government to try and encroach on those fundamental rights, it's going to be taxation. And that's exactly where we're at today when
exactly.
we deal with employment taxes.
Exactly. Okay.
Employment taxes are contained in subtitle C of the Internal Revenue Code. And I just want to give your listeners a brief framework that this isn't, I'm going to try and keep this from being technical, but I'm going to throw just a few numbers at you.
Okay.
Subtitle C is comprised of chapters 21, 22, 23, 23A, 24, and 25. That's it. That's
okay.
all that's in Subtitle C.
And Subtitle C, like Subtitle A, is within Title 26, correct?
That is correct. It is part of the Internal Revenue Code.
Okay.
Now, we don't need to worry about Chapter 25 because that's just general provisions relating to employment taxes. It's a bunch of administrative rules, if this, then that.
Okay.
So we can dispense with that. So really what we need to look at are Chapters 21, 22, 23, 23A, and 24.
Okay.
Now, 21 deals with FICA, Federal Insurance Contribution Act, what we commonly know as Social Security tax.
Right.
So we want to keep that one on the board.
Okay.
And because we're going to want to look at that. Chapter 23 deals with railroad retirement. Sorry, Chapter 22 deals with railroad retirement. We can get rid of that. That doesn't affect us for the general purpose of this conversation.
Right.
Chapter 23 is FUTA. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. That's Federal Unemployment Tax Act. Chapter 23A is railroad unemployment. We can get rid of that. We don't need to talk about that. And, of course, the big bugaboo, what gets most people, is Chapter 24, which is entitled Collection of Income Tax at Source on Wages.
Okay.
Okay. Now, that's the one that most employers say, see, it's right there in Chapter 24. It says that when we have employees, we have to withhold. We have to get you to sign a W-4. See, it says it right there.
Right.
What we're going to find out, though, when we actually look at what the law that Congress has enacted, is that the employer's understanding, and unfortunately their CPA's understanding and their tax attorney's understanding, is just flat wrong. Now, I know that's a bold statement, but I doubt that there's even a single one of your listeners that's going to dispute that bold statement by the end of this show.
Okay.
All right. Every single one of the chapters in Subtitle C that we're going to be looking at imposes a tax, except Chapter 24, which is the one I told you is the big bugaboo.
Right.
Okay. Chapter 21, it says, there is hereby imposed on the income of every individual. Imposed is the word the government has to use when they want to tax you.
Right.
Chapter 22, in addition to other taxes, there is hereby imposed. Chapter 23, there is hereby imposed on every employer. Chapter 23A, there is hereby imposed on every rail employer. So we notice it's imposed. And that's the language we find in the subtitle A when it imposes a tax also.
Right.
Now, we get to Chapter 24. Again, this is the one that employers say, this requires me to withhold. Now, let's look at the beginning, the opening language. By the way, the word imposed does not exist anywhere in Chapter 24.
Okay.
So let's listen to the opening sentence of Chapter 24. Except as otherwise provided in this section, every employer making payment of wages shall deduct and withhold upon such wages. Do you hear in that statement the imposition of any tax?
No, but maybe if you would just read it for us again.
Absolutely. Except as otherwise provided in this section, every employer making payments of wages shall deduct and withhold upon such wages.
Right.
Now, admittedly, shall deduct and withhold is a commandment.
Sure.
But a commandment to do a thing is not the same as Congress imposing a tax.
Okay.
So it may be possible to command someone in some circumstance to do a thing, but it always has to be tied to the imposition of a tax, if we're talking about, of course, the tax code.
Okay.
So we have to ask ourselves, if you're using terms like every employer on the payment of wages that they shall, which, by the way, is mandatory, that's not permissive,
right,
okay, deduct and withhold upon such wages, we have to understand, we have to figure out what it is Congress is talking about.
Okay.
And that is actually something that's not too terribly difficult to do. Interestingly, whenever we have these discussions with anybody, they always refer to Section 3402, which is what I was just reading from.
Right.
That's the second section within Chapter 24.
Okay.
And that's the one they say, see, right here, says we have to. But interestingly, you notice the second section. It's not the first section. And ironically, I have a government CD here, and whenever I try and enter and do a search for the first section, it won't give me the first section. It gives me the second section, which I find ironic because it's the first section that really pulls the veil off of what's going on.
Okay, so 3402 is the second section of Chapter 24. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay.
3401 is the first section.
Makes sense.
And, interestingly, it is the definition section.
Okay.
Now, let me take a moment and tell your listeners how definitions work in statutory law.
Okay.
If you use a word like, say, dog, and you and the Congress does not define dog for the use in the statute, then you have to go to Webster to find out what a dog is.
Okay.
However, if Congress defines dog, we can no longer consider Webster's definition because it doesn't matter. Only the definition that Congress has given matters once they have given one.
Okay.
So, for instance, if Congress defined dog as a vehicle propelled by an internal combustion motor upon the highway, we would know that for the purpose of that law, dog means what we commonly know as car.
Right.
And whenever Congress has provided a definition, again, that's the only one we're allowed to use.
Right.
So the definition section is critical. So we go to 3401, which is the first section of Chapter 24, and the very first definition we find there is wages. And it says, for the purpose of this chapter, the term wages means all remunerations for services performed by an employee.
Okay.
Now, probably so far, the people listening are going, and so what?
Right. Sounds commonsensical.
Exactly. But if we go down to 3401C, which contains the definition of employee, it is interesting to hear how employee is defined. And remember, we can only use Congress's definition, not what we in our ordinary minds would think employee would mean.
Right.
So here's what Congress says it means for the purpose of Chapter 24. For the purpose of this chapter, the term employee includes an officer, employee, or elected official of the United States, a state, or any political subdivision thereof, or the District of Columbia, or any agency or instrumentality of any one or more of the foregoing.
Okay.
Did you hear anything in that definition that remotely describes you and me out in the private sector?
No. Let me just interject here a couple things. I'm looking at Joe Bannister's book, and there's one more sentence. I don't know if there are several more sentences and how much relevant they are. But the next sentence would be, the term employee also includes an officer of a corporation. Do you have that?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And the reason I didn't bring it up is, first of all, we're not generally having this discussion as far as talking to officers of corporations
own
withholding. And secondly, that description actually means officers of federally owned or controlled corporations, not ordinary corporations.
Okay, and the reason I bring that up, Dave, is, well, a couple things. Number one, it's interesting that they use the word employee in the definition of employee, which is sort of something we were all taught, you know, sort of not to do back in grade school, right?
Right.
Okay, but then secondly, they specifically say the term employee includes an officer of a corporation. So you would think, having listed, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, but having listed this definition of these various categories, an elected official of the United States, state, or political subdivision of District of Columbia, and so on, if it meant in addition to those specific uses of the term employee, also the general definition, you would think that they would have added it in another sentence there or shortly thereafter, right?
Absolutely.
And they didn't.
Clearly,
I
believe, Peter, you're familiar with the quote from Gould v. Gould.
Sure.
Where the court said that tax law may not be expanded by implication.
Exactly.
In other words, we can't extrapolate something which is wholly unreasonable from what the words say.
Right.
So, for instance, in this definition of employee at 3401C, it clearly is talking about government workers.
Right.
So it would be absolutely illogical to say, let's see, the language Congress has adopted talks about government workers. So let's presume, in the absence of anything that says so, that it means everybody in the private sector.
Right. And the point I was trying to make is the fact that they added a sentence saying it also includes an officer of a corporation, which you say is, you know, a federal corporation, but that would have been the time or the place right there to say, oh, in addition to these folks that work for the federal government, we mean common folks like you. And they didn't do it there.
And, of course, they have the opportunity to clarify all of these things
sure.
when they want to.
Sure.
As a matter of fact, let me give you an example. Because somebody out there might be saying to themselves, you know, it's implied, or Congress just, you know, they just didn't get the language quite right, but it really does mean private sector.
Right.
Well, let me point out that when Congress means private sector, they say private sector. Let me take you to another definition of employer. I'm sorry, this the first one we defined was employee. This is employer.
Okay.
This is from Title 20, Section 6103, and it says, as used in this chapter, the term employer includes both public and private employers.
Right.
So clearly, Congress knows exactly how to designate private persons when Congress wants to.
Okay.
And just as clearly in Section 3401C, the definition of employee, they have not done that.
Right. Okay. I just wanted to make the case, you know, as strongly as we could for the listeners who aren't privy to reading the text, as you and I are.
Very well.
Okay.
Now, going on, there's also 3401D is the definition of employer.
Right.
And it essentially says an employer is anybody for whom an employee works.
Right.
Okay. So if we know what the definition of employee is, we know who the employer must be, mm-hmm. and the employer is obviously somebody who employs one of these government workers defined in 3401C.
Right.
Now, somebody might say, yeah, but that definition of employer is quite vague at D. You know, you're stretching there, Dave. Now, I don't believe it is a stretch, but for the sake of argument, let's say somebody has some merit to that argument.
Okay.
Oftentimes there are parts in the code that dovetail with one another, and if you spend enough time in the code, you'll actually find them. And here's exactly an example of that. Section 6331, which deals with levy and distraint, subsection A deals with the authority of the secretary.
Okay.
It has some general language to begin with, and then it comes to this. Levy may be made upon the accrued salaries or wages of any officer, employee, or elected official of the United States, is this sounding familiar?
Yep.
The District of Columbia, or any agency or instrumentality of the United States, or the District of Columbia, by serving notice of levy on the employer as defined in 3401D.
Wow.
So in 6331, they are clarifying beyond any question of a doubt that the employer of these officers, employees, elected officials, and so on, is a government paymaster.
Right.
And is not the private sector.
Right.
So what we find when we look at these, at the actual definitions, is that what the common wisdom would have people believe is not at all what the language of the code says.
Exactly.
And I know a lot of employers who are listening to this right now as they're driving down the street are saying, but my accountant is never going to buy that, or my tax attorney, you know, he would have told me if this were so.
Right.
My answer to that is twofold. First of all, ladies and gentlemen, those of you who are employers, look this up. If you didn't get the sections written down now, I can assure you this interview will eventually be posted on Original Intent. You can listen to it again, and you can get all the code sections. Or you can contact me at nontaxpayer.org, and you can read these sections for yourself. Now, why would you want to read them for yourself when your CPA or your tax attorney says, well, that's not so? You would want to do that because it's important to remember that your CPA and your tax attorney are merely resources to you. They should not properly be the decision maker for your business.
Right.
You should be the decision maker for your business, and you should make those decisions based upon what you know to be true, factual, and honest. Not what somebody says, well, forget what it says. Don't worry about what the language is. Who cares how it reads? Just do what I tell you.
Right.
How disingenuous is that?
Exactly. Well, Dave, we're due for a break here. Perhaps this is a good point to do that. And then when we come back, we'll see if some people want to call in. I do want to give you time to get the rest of your information out, though.
Okay, great.
So stay with us. You're listening to Peter Mac Show. I've got my host, Dave Champion, on with me. We'll be back here in just a couple minutes. Welcome back to the Peter Mac Show. I'm your host, Peter McCandless. My special guest today is Dave Champion, Executive Director of Original Intent, also the founder of NonTaxpayer.org, and a fellow radio talk show host at AmericanRadioShow.us. And we're discussing basically what the definition of employee and employer are in the code. That is, what does the law actually say? And anybody that wants to call in can do so at 816-792-1140 or 576-7800 or *1140 on a Verizon wireless call phone. And we have one caller already, is that correct? Okay, Georgia? Georgia?
Yes.
Go ahead, you're on the Peter Mac Show.
Okay, I wanted to ask a question that the, I think it was a senator's or something, had housekeepers, immigrant housekeepers, and they got in trouble for not paying taxes for those people's employment. And whenever I hire somebody to work for me, I have to collect their Social Security number to turn in when I, you know, pay them so I can show how much I paid a person for working for me. Is that, those are questions I have. Do I have to do that or not?
Dave?
Okay.
Go ahead.
First of all, let's talk about what you said about, I think it was a congresswoman.
Yes.
Who got in trouble for not, I believe it was withholding Social Security taxes from a domestic worker.
Wasn't that Linda Chavez, maybe? I'm not sure. But
I hard to remember.
Okay.
The point is that many people do not understand what the law says, and regrettably, I actually have an expression which is few people know less about the law than attorneys. And the reason for that is attorneys generally do not read law. What they do is read books about the law. So much of what you have heard today, George, on this show, CPAs and tax attorneys and ordinary attorneys don't even know it. And this includes, I'm sad to say, our congressmen and our senators. So if a congresswoman believes, because she's never read the law, that she's required to collect Social Security taxes, then there is no problem when the government comes along and says, hey, you need to do that, because her answer is, oh, okay, golly gosh, I guess I better do that.
Because they don't want any problems.
Or they're just ignorant. They don't know what the law really says.
Okay.
Now, Social Security is a little different issue than what we've been focusing on, Chapter 24, and if we have time before the end of the show, we can take a look at Chapter 21. But you asked another question, which is when people come to work for you, do you have to get their Social Security numbers and withhold from them?
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, Georgia, I don't know your personal circumstances, and therefore I can't give you a directed answer to you, Georgia, but I can tell you that the vast majority of Americans, when they contract with another person for that person's labor, are under no legal obligation to ask for or even allow the person to provide a Social Security number. And, for instance, many of my clients, their applications for their workers that come to work don't even have a spot for a Social Security number, and they never begin the entire process that you're talking about because they know what the statute actually says, and they know to whom the statutes actually apply, and more importantly, they know to whom the statutes do not apply.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm not a federal corporation. I'm a private LLC, and I hire people to do work for me.
What I would recommend, Georgia, again, because I'm not an attorney, and even if I was, I couldn't give legal advice in a forum like this, may I suggest that you go to originalintent.org,
okay.
Click on the education portal,
okay.
And then there's some topics down along the left, and there's about, I think, five or six treatises there that deal with tax law.
Okay.
I'd suggest you read them all because it'll give you a wonderful understanding. But if you want to short-circuit it and just focus in on one item, there is one there that says federal employment taxes.
Okay.
And you might want to read that and take a look at, because it has a longer, more in-depth version of what we've been saying here. And really, American tax law is not based on what your CPA says or what your tax attorney says. American tax law is based on each American understanding what the law requires and doesn't require, and then based on that understanding, doing the correct thing.
Okay. I thank you, Mr. Champion.
Thanks, Georgia.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Okay, Dave, go ahead then with the continuation, if you need to, on clarification of employee versus employer and just exactly what the definitions say.
Well, I think we pretty much clarified
okay.
what the definition of employer and employee are.
Okay.
But it's important to note that no tax is imposed by Chapter 24, just as sort of a summary, that there is a command to deduct and withhold, and that command to deduct and withhold is upon the employer, who is various government employers, and it is they must deduct and withhold from wages paid to the employees, and again, these are all statutory terms,
right?
And the employee is any one of various government workers.
Right.
So, again, the same advice that I gave to Georgia would apply to anybody who's listening to go to original intent and get themselves educated.
Right.
Now, the issue that we didn't touch upon initially, but I think I mentioned it, was the FICA and FUTA.
Right.
These are the Social Security type taxes. And you wouldn't be surprised to learn that the same game of definitions is used in FICA and FUTA. Now, people will sometimes say, especially tax attorneys and whatnot, they'll say, well, the Supreme Court has upheld the constitutionality of Social Security. Well, yes, and I agree with that. Social Security is constitutional.
Right.
The question is it being applied correctly? Is it
right.
being applied to the right people? Is it being applied in the correct circumstances that it was intended when Congress chose the language that they chose?
Right.
Now, it's important to realize that there was an act before the Social Security Act that was very similar to it. It was called the Railroad Retirement Act. And the Supreme Court struck that down, saying that even though something may be good for people, like providing them retirement, in America, you can't create a law enforcement to participate in that.
Wow.
That's not one of the powers the government has.
Mm-hmm.
So then when the Social Security Act was created, we have to question, how was it different than the Railroad Security Act that was struck down by the court? Well, they changed it by altering definitions, and let me share with you what those definitions are.
Okay.
In Section 3121A, which is in Chapter 21, we find the definitions that are used. Okay, now the first definition is wages. And it reads, and your listeners are going to recognize this game right off, for the purpose of this chapter, the term wages means all remuneration for employment. And then it goes on to talk about the rest of it. But it is remuneration for employment.
Okay.
The key word there would be employment. How does Congress define employment for the purposes of this chapter?
Right.
Then we drop down to 3121B, where it defines employment. For the purpose of this chapter, the term employment means any service of whatever nature performed by an employee for the person employing him, irrespective of the citizenship or residence of either within the United States. And then it goes on to talk about American aircraft and American vessels.
Right.
But most of your listeners are saying, well, you know, I work in Missouri or Kansas. Of course I'm working within the United States.
Right.
But again, we have to remember, Congress can define these words to mean anything they want to mean. And it is sometimes, the game is sometimes so horrendous that people hear about it and say, that can't be true. Congress can't be playing those kind of games. They can't be being that sneaky.
Right.
They can't be taking my money based on deceit. Well, they can. Let me read now the definition of state and United States as used in the same chapter we were just talking about, Chapter 21.
Okay.
When used in the regulations of this subpart, the term state includes the District of Columbia, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, the territories of Alaska and Hawaii before their admission as states, and Guam and American Samoa.
Okay.
Now, there's a laundry list of what, for the purposes of this chapter, the government has said is a state.
Right.
You didn't hear anything about California, Arizona, Nebraska. All we heard about were things like the District of Columbia.
Right.
Which the Supreme Court has said is not a constitutional state.
Okay.
The Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands. Now, here's the kicker. The territories of Alaska and Hawaii before their admissions as states. So, Alaska and Hawaii were considered states when they were mere territories, such as Puerto Rico and Guam and the Virgin Islands.
Right.
However, upon their admission as states of the Union, they are excluded from the definition.
Wow.
If that doesn't let people know the game that is being played.
Absolutely.
Nothing will.
Absolutely, Dave.
Now, let's move down to the definition of United States.
Okay. Then we have a caller, Dave, and we'll get to that after the after your definition of United States.
The term United States, when used in a geographic sense, means the several states, including the territories of Alaska and Hawaii before their admission as states, the District of Columbia, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico, and it goes on just like the definition of state. It's almost identical.
Okay.
So again, for the definition of United States, Alaska and Hawaii were included when they were territories, but excluded upon admission as states of the Union. Clearly, the term United States, as used in FICA, does not include the states of the Union.
Wow.
And that is because of the ruling of the Supreme Court in the Railroad Retirement Act. They could not force people in the 50 states to participate. Now, they can force people in Puerto Rico and Guam and the Virgin Islands because they are not the type of citizen that you and I are.
Right.
They do not have fundamental inalienable rights.
Right.
So they're able to force them to participate, but it would be unconstitutional if they tried to force us.
Right. Would this be a good time to take the next caller, Dave?
Why not?
Okay. Tom, go ahead. You're on the Peter Mac Show. Tom?
Hello?
Tom, go ahead.
Yes. Good to hear you. To put this in the time perspective, if I'm not correct, all of these codes and everything was put into place after they made the Earth round.
See, that is correct.
Oh, good. I just want to make sure I wouldn't fall off the Earth when I stood up in the line, you know, because I read about these things 15, 20 years ago. Irwin Schiff, I got all of his books. And I have gone through spending a lot of my time trying to explain to my neighbor that we're all being conned, we're all being treated like sacrificial animals, food for the gods. And I've realized, united we stand, individually they threaten us and throw us in jail.
You're
individually,
right about this, Tom.
They threaten us and they destroy our lives.
Okay. Tom, do you have a question for Dave?
How do we, because they've got written in all the little groups and all the supporting groups and everybody that they pay off, they got ways they kick back to them, continuing the corruption. How do we who want to be free get the word out and stand together against them?
Okay, so that's your question.
Yeah, how do we how do we stop it?
Okay, well let Dave respond, please.
Okay.
Okay, the number one answer, there's several answers, but I think the one we want to address here today is education. Now, I know it's difficult for one person to think that they can educate people, but it's really not. First of all, email is a very powerful tool to educate people, and of course, you know, we usually have people on some sort of a contact list that we have, and we don't want to barrage them with things that they don't want, but we can use that as one of the tools to let them know that there's something wrong. Now, one of the first things that come to mind is, as I think about your question, Tom, is you can tell people you need to tune in to the Peter Mac Show every Friday between 5 and 6. I'm serious about that.
Okay.
I'm not just doing that to be kind to Peter. Peter's show is putting the word out, and it's got a broadcast reach. It gets to a lot of people. There's a large audience. Secondly, you can tell people if you have any questions about this, let me give you a website. You can go ahead and give them the originalintent.org website.
Right.
If people actually know this information, Tom, and want practical assistance, let's say they say, look, I know I'm a non-taxpayer. I just need to convince the bank. I just need to convince the lender. I just need to convince my employer. You can direct them to nontaxpayer.org where they can get solutions. And lastly, these are just the things I off the top of my head, you can have them listen each week to American Radio. There's also other organizations. There's We the People Foundation, which is givemeliberty.org. If you're a regular listener to Peter's show, you know about Larkin and his website.
Right.
So really, well, there's no shortage of these are just the resources that I'm giving you off the top of my head.
Right.
There's no shortage of resources. What we need to do is be engaging, get people interested, and get them educated. Because, Tom, once we get to the point where, because you said when we stand individually, we get put on trial and we go to jail. When we get to the point where any 12 jurors you impanel, there's going to be at least one guy who knows the law and will not convict. In that case, my friend, the tax system will the misapplication of the tax system, the fraudulent part of the tax system, will evaporate overnight.
Exactly.
I have tried to counteract the passive acceptance of the state of affairs in minds of my fellow American for years, and it just amazes me. We're so programmed with don't question the gods, our masters,
right.
Don't complain because you might be destroyed or punished. And they give up.
But Tom, I think I know what you're up against, and Dave and I certainly, you know, feel that from time to time too, I think, if I can speak for him. But you're doing the right thing by talking to people and looking at the law. And, you know, and I think things are changing. People are beginning to look at it. People are looking at, you know, the website of We the People at GiveMeLiberty.org and the events that have taken place there and Larkin's website and so forth. People are beginning to look at this. If that weren't the case, Tom, Dick Sim Cannon, who unfortunately ultimately was convicted, in my view, you know, wrongly, unjustly, it took 3 or 4 grand juries to finally get an indictment against him. The first two simply would not return an indictment when they saw his evidence.
If I may, Peter, it
sure.
took a dirty judge, a judge who was the step-and-fetch lackey of the IRS, to bend and twist and mutilate the law beyond recognition
right.
in order to get Dick convicted.
Right.
Well, there are other ways that the twisted masters will destroy and convict. It's like my example. I took American constitutional interpretation over at UMKC, and it was thrown out of class and ultimately dumped out of school on the second day of class when I refuted the teacher's claim that the state owned us.
Right.
I pointed out the various things in the Constitution. I used to always carry my Constitution in my book bag. He wanted to fight me in the hall. I got thrown out. I got out of school. And that was 18 years of work down the drain because I ran into it. Damn Nazi.
Well, Tom, you know, I understand that, but let Dave move on in the remaining minutes if we could. I appreciate your call. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Tom. You know, Tom, I understand. I hear his frustration.
Oh, yeah.
And I understand. Now, see, a good example of what I would have done if I was booted out of that professor's class is I would have prepared brochures, and I would have stood out in the hallway after each of his classes, not before, because then he would have seen the paper coming in.
Right.
And I would have handed out brochures about the proper websites for people to go to learn about what the law
right.
really says.
Right.
And I would have encouraged them to challenge him more since he threw out the only person who was challenging him.
Right. Of course, as he said, I believe that was 18 years ago, and the Internet didn't even exist then, at least as it does today. So that is a very powerful tool that is the government just cannot keep people from transmitting information about what their own laws say back and forth. And I don't think any of us would be where we are, Dave, without the Internet.
Now let's talk a moment about Social Security.
Sure.
People believe that Social Security is something different, something unique, something distinct from income tax.
Okay.
And I think most of your listeners would be shocked to hear that the part of their check where it says FICA and money has been taken out
right.
is just more income tax being removed, and it has absolutely nothing to do with Social Security. Now most of the people listening are thinking, oh, this is unbelievable. He's crossed the line. This right. absolutely, positively cannot be true.
Right.
There's a case called Helvering v. Davis where the U.S. Supreme Court looked at the structure of the Social Security Act, looked at the structure of FICA taxes, and here are the determinations that the U.S. Supreme Court made. It says that the Social Security tax is a special income tax upon the employees to be deducted from their wages and paid by the employers. Now, you notice it says a special income tax.
Right.
Now, so we already know it is an income tax.
Right.
Now, let's move on to where the court says the money goes. It says the proceeds of Social Security taxes are to be paid into the Treasury like Internal Revenue taxes generally and are not earmarked in any way.
Wow.
So the money, that's the Supreme Court speaking, that's not Dave Champion.
Right.
So on their paycheck, when your listeners see FICA, what that is money, just more income tax. The court referred to it as a special income tax. I don't think it's particularly special because it's not earmarked in any way. It's just another income tax. It's just more income tax.
It's special in that it further inflicts pain.
Correct. Now, people believe that Social Security tax goes into, quote, their account.
Right.
nothing further can be, nothing is further from the truth. You just heard the Supreme Court say it goes into the Treasury's general fund and it's not earmarked in any way.
Right.
So not one penny that is paid in FICA taxes goes into the workers', quote, account. All that happens at the end of the year, based on, quote, wages, and there's wages for withholding purposes and wages for Social Security purposes, mm-hmm. and that's because we talked about the different definitions apply to the different chapters. What they do is they take your Social Security wages, they look at the total amount that you made, and then they figure how many credits you get, and credits are nothing more than an ephemeral computer entry.
Mm-hmm.
And so they say, okay, Bob Smith gets 31 credits for the year 2003.
Mm-hmm.
And they put credits, which is nothing more than tick marks in a computer. And then when it comes time to retire, they say, okay, cumulatively over all the years that Bob Smith has worked, how many of these little tick marks are on my computer screen?
Right.
These are the credits. Not one penny goes into a Social Security account.
And
or,
Dave,
or even a trust fund, which is another thing that the government lies about.
Well, Dave, let me just read a quote, if I can, that backs up what you just said. This is from the Comptroller General of the United States in a speech he gave on September 17th of this year to the National Press Club. This I pulled off the website, www.gao.gov, and it specifically says this, quote, specifically, there are a number of very significant items that are not currently included as liabilities in the federal government's financial statements. For example, several $1 trillion in non-marketable government securities in so-called trust funds. In the case of the Social Security and Medicare trust funds, the federal government took in taxpayer money, spent it on other items, and replaced it with an IOU. Given this fact, why aren't the amounts attributed to such activities shown as a liability of the U.S. government? At the present time, they are not. Does this make sense, especially when the government continues to tell Social Security and Medicare beneficiaries that they can count on the bonds in these trust funds? Is the government trying to have its cake and eat it too, unquote. That's from the Comptroller General of the United States.
Right. Now, the other that's very compelling, and it really does cement the position we were talking about. But I think people need to understand that the money that is paid out for Social Security each year, no matter whether it's disability or regular ordinary old age benefits, it is appropriated each year by Congress as a part of the ordinary budget process.
Right.
It does not come from a trust fund. It does not come from, quote, your account.
Right.
It is appropriated each and every year. Now, here is the scariest part, I think, especially for people who really believe in their government. The Supreme Court has said that if Congress repealed all of the Social Security laws tomorrow, the people who had paid into Social Security for a lifetime would have no recourse or remedy at law against the government.
Right.
Because what they pay goes into the general fund and gets spent, and what they receive is appropriated each year as part of the normal appropriations process.
Exactly.
That nobody earns the right to anything by contributing to Social Security.
Right.
It is not like an insurance policy where you pay your premiums each month and you have a legal enforceable right to receive funds if a particular event occurs.
Right.
You have no such right with Social Security. It could evaporate tomorrow.
Right. And yet,
that just doesn't mean the government going broke. That means Congress is changing their mind.
Exactly. Dave, we're down to just about a minute, so use the time in whatever way you see fit to summarize the issues that we've gone over today. And once again, this is Dave Champion, Executive Director of the OriginalIntent.org, also founder of non-taxpayer.org, and host of AmericanRadioShow.us. Go ahead,
quick
Dave.
Statements. First of all, the federal courts have distinguished between taxpayers and non-taxpayers. The IRS only speaks to and about taxpayers. You need to go somewhere else to get information on non-taxpayers. If you are an employer and you have questions about this and you want to know how to do the right thing, please feel free to contact nontaxpayer.org so that we can show you how to make the necessary transition and do it safely and lawfully.
Right. Well, Dave, thanks very much for being on. And, post this on your website and... For my listeners, thanks for tuning in. I'll have another good show for you next week at the Peter Mac Show. If you want to get any of my shows, just email me at petermacshow.com. We'll be back next week.